Hey guys, it's reading day, and I'm going to be reading from The Book of Werewolves, a book written in the 1800s. We'll be right back. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Hey everybody, welcome. Happy Sunday. Does TikTok come in before I start? Hey everybody, how's it going? My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. We are 45 strong up and down the state, which means if you have a paranormal issue or you think you might have one, we can get to you. It might take a while because California is a huge state, but we definitely can get to you. Hello TikTok, how's it going? For those of you just coming in the room, join me. Anyway, that being said, we are broadcasting live to TikTok today along with Facebook, Twitch, and YouTube. And this is Sunday Reading Day where we do read from a paranormal themed book. So as you're watching the show, if you like what you see, please be sure to hit that follow button if you're watching from TikTok, or hit that subscribe button if you're watching from YouTube. I would really appreciate it because we're always looking for followers. Same thing with Twitch and TikTok. You want to follow me? That's great too. But please hit that those buttons. And during the show, feel free to comment. And during the show, feel free to comment. I can't see your comments right away because I'm a distance with the laptop, just like over on TikTok. Welcome, I see you rolling in. Getting ready to do our Sunday reading day. But I do know you're there. I see you. And please, and remember, thumbs up, happy faces, happy hearts things. And that helps us with the FYP, which is the For You page, moves us out to more people. And if you like what you hear and see today, why don't you share this? Every Sunday I read from a paranormal theme book. Daily I do a paranormal theme show. So it's a talk show over at youtube.com/@CaliforniaHauntsRadio. And we do paranormal guests all week long. But Sunday is the day that everybody's trying to get ready for work. And, and they're having their coffee. And a lot of places, it's already 9 p.m. at night. So people are getting ready to go to work. And this is the way to do it. You put your fuzzy slippers on, light your fire. Turn on your fire. It's electric, right? And settle down in. And I'm going to read to you for an hour from a paranormal themed book. This book is Werewolves. We are on our fifth day reading about werewolves. These books are copyright free. They were written in the late 1800s. And there's a place called Project Gutenberg. And if you go over there, there's all kinds of books there. And they're all copyright free. And all you have to, and then they run anywhere from the early 1800s all the way up to the 1940s. And that's it. They're all out of copyright. So they're all free. All kinds of topics over there. All kinds of topics. All right, so I'm going to be reading for about an hour, and I always read from a paranormal themed book. It might be true, it may be fake paranormal stuff. This, who knows, it's a legend of the werewolf, right? So over on TikTok, I have a goal of 1,000 likes. So if you could double tap that screen while I'm reading, I would really appreciate it. I also have a nice helm up there for my goal. I'd appreciate that, but you don't have to. No, nobody's required to donate, but I would appreciate it because I am trying to build up my numbers and pay my bills just like everybody else. And but anyway, like I said, I'm going to be reading for about an hour, and I cannot see the screen on my cell phone. Word of warning on TikTok, please double tap that screen. Thank you. I see the hearts going up. Is that I'm having trouble with the charging ports on my iPhone. So the cable has to be at a certain position, and unfortunately, to do this show, it won't work in the position I have to have it in. So if I lose you at some point during the show, it's not because I cut you all off. It's because the phone died. Okay? All right. Here we go. And that being said, I will read for about an hour today. And then I'll let you guys be and get back into your weekend. Okay? So here we go. The Book of Werewolves. And I think we're in chapter 7 or chapter 8. I don't do Roman numerals, so it's chapter VIII. Folklore relating to werewolves. That's the chapter thing. So here we go. enjoy, sit back and enjoy. And please TikTok, please double tap that screen. Like I said, I have a goal of 1,000 likes. If you could do that for me, I'd really appreciate it. Okay, my name is Charlotte. I'll be your host. Here we go. Baroness of English Folklore, Devonshire Traditions. This is the summary of what's going to be in the chapter. In fact, I'm going to skip that because I've been reading those and they're kind of stupid. Not stupid, but boring. English folklore is singularly barren of werewolf stories. The reason being that wolves have been extirpated from England under the Anglo-Saxon kings and therefore ceased to be objects of dread of the people. The traditional belief in werewolfism must, however, have remained long in the popular mind. I'm double-checking my time, so I know what time to stop. Though at present, it has disappeared, for the word occurs in old ballads and romances. Thus, in Campion, oh, was it werewolf in the wood? Or was it a mermaid in the sea? Or was it man or vile woman? My ain true love, that misshaped thee. There is also the romance of William and the werewolf in Hartshorne. But this professes to be a translation from the French. Hartshorne. Okay. I'm going to try and read this, so here we go. For he at French this fair tale first deed translate in ease of English men in English speech. Okay. In the popular mind, the cat or the hare have taken the place of the wolf for witch's transformation. And we hear often of the hags attending the devil's Sabbath in these forms. In Devonshire, they range the moors in the shape of black dogs. And I know a story or two of such creatures appearing in an inn and nightly drinking the cider till the publican shot a silver button over their heads, when they were instantly transformed into two ill-favored old ladies of his acquaintance. On Heathfield, near Tavistock, the wild huntsman rides by full moon with his wush hounds and a white hare, which they pursued, was once rescued by a goody returning from the market and discovered to be a transformed young lady. Gervais of Tilbury says, in his memory, Vitimus frequor in Anglia per lunaticinus, oh my god, homines in lupos mutari quad. Okay, translation. Here we go. Let's see. Gervais may be right, since none of us speak Latin, so I'm just gonna jump ahead here. Gervais may be right in his derivation of the name, and werewolf may mean man-wolf, though I have elsewhere given a different derivation, and one which I suspect is truer. But Gervais has grounds for his assertion that weir signifies man. It is so in Anglo-Saxon, ver in Gothic, vir in Latin, ver in Icelandic, vira, zend, weirs, Old Prussian weirs, litish, vira, Sanskrit, beer, Bengali. There have been cases of cannibalism in Scotland, but no bestial transformation is hinted at in connection with them. Thus, Boethius, in his History of Scotland, tells us of a robber and his daughter who devoured children, and Lindsay of Visconti gives a full account. Okay, guys, now that we're going to be talking about this, please do not turn me into the TikTok police or the Facebook police or any of those other police. This book is from the 1800s, so you got to remember that. It's like watching a horror movie, right? Okay, it's like watching a horror movie. Okay, double tap that screen, guys. About this time, which was 1460, there was Anne Brigden Tain with his Hale family, who haunted a place in Angus. This mischievous man had an execrable fashion to take all young men and children he could steal away quietly, or take away without knowledge, and eat them. And the younger they were, esteemed them in the manner tender and delicious. For the will cause of damnable abuse, he with his wife and barons were all burnt, except a young wench of a year old, who was saved and brought to Dandy, where she was brought up and fostered. And when she came to a woman's years, she was condemned and burnt quick for that crime. It is said that when she was coming to the place of execution, there gathered a huge multitude of people, especially of women, cursing her that she was so unhappy to commit such deeds, to whom she turned about with an ireful countenance, saying, "Wherefore chide ye with me, as if I had committed an unworthy act? Give me credence and trow me. If ye had experience of eating man and women's flesh, ye would think it so delicious that ye would never forbear it again. So, but any sign of repentance, this unhappy traitor died in the sight of the people. Deep. Wintown also has a passage in his metrical chronicle regarding a cannibal who lived shortly before his own time, and he may easily have heard about him from surviving contemporaries. It was about the year 1340 when a large portion of Scotland had been devastated by the arms of Edward III. Okay? So here I go. About Perth there was the country, say waste, that wander west to sea, for until one great space thereby was another house left nor Herbroy, I'm trying. Of deer there was then sick foison, oh profusion, okay, that they would near come to the town. Say great default was near that stead, that money were in hunger dead. A carle they said was near thereby that would act. Oh, that would act traps commonly. Children and women for to slay, and swains that he meant overtake, and ate them all that he got might choost and cleek till name be hight. That sere life continued he, while waste but folk was the country. Wow. Okay. Bear with me, guys. I'm just old English, old Scottish, old. So just trying to get through this stuff. We've only to compare these two cases with those recorded in the last two chapters, and we see at once how the popular mind in Great Britain had lost the idea of connecting change of form with cannibalism. A man guilty of the crimes committed by the Angus brigand or the Carle of Perth would have been regarded as a werewolf in France or Germany and would have been tried for lycanthropy. S. Jerome, by the way, brought a sweeping charge against the Scots. He visited Gaul in his youth about 880. And he writes, "When I was a young man in Gaul, I may have seen the Atticotti, a British people who live upon human flesh. And when they find herds of pigs, droves of cattle, or flocks of sheep in the woods, they cut off the haunches and of the men and the breasts of the women, and these they regard as great dainties." Yikes. In other words, they prefer the shepherd to his flock. Gibbon, who quotes the passage, says on it, "If in the neighborhood of the commercial and literary town of Glasgow, a race of cannibals has really existed, we may contemplate in a period of Scottish history the opposite extremes of savage and civilized life. Such reflections tend to enlarge the circle of our ideas and to encourage the pleasing hope that New Zealand may produce in the future age the Hume of the Southern Hemisphere. In traditions of werewolves are the scanty, if traditions of werewolves are scanty in England, it is quite the reverse if we cross the water. In the south of France, it is still believed that fate has destined certain men to be werewolves, that they are transformed into wolves at full moon. The desire to run comes upon them at night. They leave their beds, jump out of a window, and plunge into a fountain. After the bath, they come out covered with dense fur, walking on all fours, and commence a raid over fields and meadows, through woods and villages, biting all beasts and human beings that come in their way. At the approach of dawn, they return to the spring, plunge into it, lose their furry skins, and regain their deserted beds. Sometimes, the loup-garou is said to appear under the form of a white dog or to be loaded with chains. But there is probably confusion of ideas between the werewolf and the church dog. Barguest, patefoit, whoosh hound, or by whatever name the animal is supposedly to haunt the churchyard is designated. In the Perigord, the werewolf is called Lularoo. Certain men, especially those without fathers, are obliged each full moon to transform themselves into these diabolical beasts. It is always at night that the fit comes on. The werewolf dashes out the window, springs into a well, and after having struggled in the water for a few moments, rises from it, dripping and invested with a goat skin, which the devil has given him. In this condition, the Lularoos run upon four legs, pass the night in ranging over the country, and in biting and devouring all the dogs they meet. At break of day, they lay aside their goat skins and return home. Often, they are ill in consequence, and having eaten tough old hounds, and they vomit up their undigested paws. One great nuisance to them is the fact that they may be wounded or killed in their Lularoo state. With the first effusion of blood, their diabolical covering vanishes, and they are recognized to the disgrace of their families. A werewolf may easily be detected, even when devoid of his skin, for his hands are broad and his fingers are short. Whoa. Short fingers. Why is my nose red? I look like Rudolph. Look at that. Look at my nose is red. Okay, anyway. Never mind. You guys don't see it at Facebook. I see it on TikTok. So I'm sorry. In Normandy, those who are doomed to be loup garou clothe themselves every evening with a skin called their air or hure, which is a loan from the devil. When they run in their transformed state, the evil one accompanies them and scourges them at the foot of every cross they pass. Okay. The only way in which the werewolf can be liberated from this cruel bondage is by stabbing him 3 times in the forehead with a knife. Ooh, kind of like zombies. Walking Dead, right? Like the Walking Dead zombies. However, some people less addicted to allopathic treatment consider that 3 drops of blood drawn by a needle will be sufficient to procure release. I'm going to blow this up a little bit. Okay. According to opinion, when they run in their transformed state, the evil one accompanies them. Okay, sorry about that. I'm down here. I blew it up and it jumped on me. According to an opinion of the vulgar in the same province, the loup garou is sometimes a metamorphosis forced upon the body of a damned person who, after having been tormented in his grave, has torn his way out of it. The first stage of the process consists in his devouring the care cloth which envelopes his face. Then his moans and muffled howls ring from the tomb through the gloom of night. The earth of the grave begins to heave. And at last, with a scream, surrounded by a phosphorescent glare and exhaling a fetid odor, he bursts away as a wolf. In Libesin, they attribute to sorcerers the power of metamorphosing certain men into beasts. But the form of a dog is that principality affected by them. In Norway, it is believed that there are persons who can assume the form of a wolf or a bear. There's a name for it. I'm not reading it. Norwegian, I don't get along. And again, resume their own. This property is either imparted to them by the trollmen, or those possessing it are themselves trolls. I'm just going to watch the power on here. Okay. In a hamlet in the midst of a forest, there dwelt a cottager named Lassie and his wife. One day, he went out in the forest to fell a tree, but had forgot to cross himself and say his paternoster, so that some troll or wolf witch, Vargamora, obtained power over him and transformed him into a wolf. His wife mourned him for many years, but one Christmas Eve, there came a bigger woman, very poor and ragged, to the door. And the good woman of the house took her in, fed her well, and entreated her kindly. At her departure, the bigger woman said that the wife would probably see her husband again, as he was not dead. But this was wandering in the forest as a wolf. Towards nightfall, the wife went to her pantry to place in a piece of meat for the morrow. When, on turning to go out, she perceived a wolf standing before her, raising itself with its paws on the pantry steps, regarding her with sorrowful and hungry looks. Seeing this, she exclaimed, "If I were sure that thou were my own lass, I would give thee a bit of the meat." At that instant, the wolf skin fell off, and her husband stood before her in the clothes he wore on the unlucky morning when she had last beheld him. Finns, Laps, and Russians are held in particular aversion, because the Swedes believe that they have power to change people into wild beasts. During the last year of the war with Russia, when Kalmar was overrun with an unusual number of wolves, it was generally said that the Russians had transformed their Swedish prisoners into wolves and sent them home to invest the country. In Denmark, the following stories are told. A man who from his childhood had been a werewolf, when returning one night with his wife from a merrymaking, observed that an hour was at hand when the evil usually came upon him. Giving, therefore, the reins to his wife, he descended from the vehicle, saying to her, "If anything comes to thee, only strike it with thine apron." He then withdrew, but immediately after, the woman, as she was sitting in the vehicle, was attacked by a werewolf. She did as the man had enjoined her, and struck it with her apron, from which it writhed a portion, and then ran away. After some time, the man returned, holding in his mouth the rent portion of his wife's apron, on seeing which, she cried out in terror, "Good Lord, man, why thou art werewolf? "Thank thee, wife," said he. "Now I am free." And from that time he was no more afflicted. If a female at midnight stretches between four sticks the membrane which envelopes the foal, it is brought forth, and creeps through it naked, she will bear children without pain. But all the boys will be werewolves, and all the girls maras. By day the werewolf has a human form, though he may be known by the meaning of his eyebrows above the nose. At a certain time of the night, he has the form of a dog on three legs. It is only when another person tells him that he is a werewolf, or reproaches him with being such, that a man can be freed from the ban. According to a Danish popular song, a hero transformed by his stepmother into a bear fights with a knight. "For 'tis she who hath bewitched me, a woman false and fell, bound an iron girdle round me, if thou canst not break this belt, knight, I'll thee destroy." The noble made the Christian sign, the girdle snapped, the bear was changed, and see, he was a lusty knight, his father's realm regained. Interesting. When an old bear in Offidens, this is Swedish, okay? When an old bear in Offidens Prestigild was killed, after it had caused the death of 6 men and 60 horses, was found to be girded with a similar girdle. In Schleswig and Holstein, they say that if the werewolf thrice addressed by his baptismal name, he resumes his human form. If the werewolf be thrice addressed, okay. On a hot harvest day, some reapers lay down in the field to take their noontide sleep, when one who could not sleep observed that the fellow next to him rose softly, and having girdled himself with a strap, became a werewolf. A young man belonging to Jägerup, returning late one night from Bulund, was attacked when near Jägerup by 3 werewolves, and would probably have been torn to pieces had he not saved himself by leaping into a rye field, for there they had no more power over him. At Caseburg, on the Isle of Usedom, a man and his wife were busy in the field making hay, when after some time the woman said to the man that she had no more peace, she could stay no longer, and went away. But she had previously desired her husband to promise that if purchase a wild beast should come that way, he would cast his hat at it and then run away, and it would do him no injury. She had been gone but a short while when a wolf came swimming across the swine and ran directly towards the haymaker. The man threw his hat at it, which the animal instantly tore to rags. But in the meantime, a boy had run up with a pitchfork, and he dabbed the wolf from behind. In the same moment, it became changed, and all saw that the boy had killed the man's wife. Heavy. Formerly, there were individuals in the neighborhood of Steina who, by putting on a certain girdle, could transform themselves into werewolves. A man of the neighborhood, who had such a girdle, forgot one day when going out to lock it up, as was his wont. During his absence, his little son chanced to find it. He buckled it round him and was instantaneously turned into an animal, to all outward appearance like a bundle of peat straw, and he rolled about like an unwieldy bear. When those who were in the room perceived this, they hastened in search of the father, who was found in time to come and unbuckle the belt, before the child had done any mischief. The boy afterwards said that when he had put on the girdle, he was seized with such a raging hunger that he was ready to tear in pieces and devour anything that came in his way. The girdle is supposed to be made of human skin, and to be 3 finger breasts wide. In East Friesland, it is believed, when 7 girls succeed each other in one family, that among them, one is of necessity a werewolf, so that youths are slow in seeking one of the 7 sisters in marriage. According to a curious Lithuanian story related by Schleicher, in his book, a person who is a werewolf or bear has to remain kneeling in one spot for 100 years before he can hope to obtain release from his bestial form. In the Netherlands, they relate the following tale. A man had once gone out with his bow to attend a shooting match at Rossi, but when about halfway to the place, he saw on a sudden a large wolf spring from a thicket and rush towards a young girl who was sitting in a meadow by the roadside, watching cows. The man did not long hesitate, but quickly drawing forth an arrow, took aim, and luckily hit the wolf in the right side, so that the arrow remained sticking in the wound, and the animal fled howling to the woods. On the following day, he heard that a serving man of the burgomaster's household lay at the point of death in consequence of having been shot in the right side on the preceding day. This so excited the archer's curiosity that he went to the wounded man and requested to see the arrow. He recognized it immediately as one of his own. Then, having desired all present to leave the room, he persuaded the man to confess that he was a werewolf and that he had devoured little children on the following day. On the following day, he died. Interesting stuff, this werewolf stuff. Interesting. Among the Bulgarians and Slovakians, I'm thinking this is Slovakians, S-L-O-Y-A-K-I-N-S. The werewolf is called Vrkolak, a name resembling that given by the Greeks, Bukulakas. I tried. The Greek werewolf is closely related to the vampire. The werewolf falls into a trance during which his soul leaves his body, enters that of a wolf, and raves on for blood. On the return of the soul, the body is exhausted and aches as though it had been put through violent exercise. After death, werewolves become vampires. They are believed to frequent battlefields in wolf or hyena shapes and to suck the breath from dying soldiers, or to enter houses and steal the infants from their cradles. Modern Greeks call any savage-looking man and with distorted, misshapen limbs a Greek werewolf, and suppose him to be invested with power of running in wolf form. The Serbs connect the vampire and the werewolf together and call him by one name. I'm trying this. V-L-K-O-S-L-A-K. We'll leave it. These range chiefly in the depths of winter. They hold their annual gatherings and at them divest themselves of their wolf skins, which they hang on the trees around them. If anyone succeeds in obtaining the skin and burning it, the werewolf is there and forth disenchanted. Okay, so the magic of the werewolf. The power to become a werewolf is obtained by drinking the water which settles in a footprint left in clay by a wolf. Ew. Among the White Russians, the Wakalak is a man who has incurred the wrath of the devil, and the evil one punishes him by transforming him into a wolf and sending him among his relations, who recognize him and feed him well. He is a most amiably disposed werewolf, for he does no mischief, and testifies his affection for his kindred by licking their hands. He cannot, however, remain long in any place, but is driven from house to house, and from hamlet to hamlet, by an irresistible passion for change of scene. This is an ugly superstition, for it sets a premium on standing well with the evil ones. The Slovakians, merely term drunkard A, Vrkolak, because forsooth he makes a beast of himself. A Slovakian household, see what I mean? They keep changing. So Slovakian, they put a Y in there. So it's back to being Slovakian. So a Slovakian household, werewolf tale closes this chapter. The Polish have their werewolves, which raise twice in the year, at Christmas and Midsummer. According to a Polish story, if a witch lays a girdle of human skin on the threshold of a house in which a marriage is being celebrated, the bride and bridegroom and bridesmaids and groomsmen, should they step across it, are transformed into wolves. After 3 years, however, the witch will cover them with skins with the hair turned outward. Immediately, they will recover their natural form. On one occasion, a witch cast a skin of too scanty dimensions over the bridegroom, so that his tail was left uncovered. He resumed his human form, but retained his tail. Okay. The Russians call the werewolf Obrat, which signifies one transformed. The following receipt is given by them for becoming one. He who desires to become an Obrat, let him seek in the forest a hewn down tree. Let him stab it with a small copper knife and walk around the tree, repeating the following incantation. On the sea, on the ocean, on the island, on Bajan. On the empty pasture gleams the moon, on an ash stalk lying, in a green wood, in a gloomy vale. Toward the stalk wandereth the shaggy wolf, horned cattle seeking for his sharp white fangs. But the wolf enters not the forest. But the wolf dies not into the dives not into the shadowy vale. Moon, moon, gold horn moon. Cheek the flight of bullets. Blunt the hunter's knives. Break the shepherd's cudgels. Cast wild fear upon old cattle. On men, on old creeping things. That they may not catch the gray wolf. That they may not rend his warm skin. My word is binding. More binding than sleep. More binding than the promise of a hero. Then he springs thrice over the tree and runs into the forest, transformed into a wolf. Cool. In the ancient Bohemian lexicon Vacerad, AD 1202, the werewolf is called Bikoldak and is explained as Faunus. Safarik says under that head, Inkyo, okay, this is not written in English, so we're just going to have to deal with it. Okay, we're going to have to skip over this. Okay, sorry, that one got, that's gone. That the same belief in lycanthropy exists in Armenia is evident from the following story told by Hexalson in his Transcaucasia. Ha! A man once saw a wolf which had carried off a child dash past him. He pursued it hastily, but was unable to overtake it. At last he came upon the hands and feet of a child, and a little further on he found a cave in which lay a wolf's skin. This he cast into a fire, and immediately a woman appeared, who howled and tried to rescue the skin from the flames. The man, however, resisted, and as soon as the hide was consumed, the woman had vanished in the smoke. In India, on account of the prevalence of the doctrine of metempsychosis, the belief in transformation is widely diffused. Traces of genuine lycanthropy are abundant in all regions whither Buddhism has reached. In Ceylon, in Tibet, and in China, we find it still forming a portion of the national creed. In the Pantscharantra, Pantscharantra, is the story of an enchanted Brahmin's son, who by day was a serpent, by night he was a man. Deep stuff. Okay, his father, okay, I cannot pronounce this guy's father, so I'm going to call him Vikra Madita, Madidya's father, the son of Indra, was condemned to be a donkey by day and a man by night. Can't say the A word, right? A modern Indian tale is to this effect. A prince marries a female ape, but his brothers wed handsome princesses. At a feast given by the queen to her stepdaughters, there appears an exquisitely beautiful lady in gorgeous robes. This is none other than the she-ape, who has laid aside her skin for the occasion. The prince slips out of the room and burns the skin, so that his wife is prevented from resuming her favorite appearance. Nathaniel Pierce gives an account of an Abyssinian superstition very similar to the prevalent to those present in Europe. He says that in Abyssinia, the gold and silversmiths are highly regarded, but that the iron workers are looked upon with contempt as an inferior grade of beings. Their kinsmen even ascribe to them the power of transforming themselves into hyenas or other savage beasts. All convulsions and hysterical disorders are attributed to the effect of their evil eye. The Amhara call them Buddha. The Tigre, Tibib. There are also Mahometan and Jewish Buddhas. It is difficult to explain the origin of this strange superstition. These Buddhas are distinguished from other people by wearing gold earrings. And Coffin declares that he has often found hyenas with these rings in their ears, even among the beasts which he has shot or speared himself. But how the rings got into their ears is more than Coffin was able to ascertain. Besides their power to transform themselves into hyenas and other wild beasts, all sorts of other strange things are ascribed to them. And the Abyssinians are firmly persuaded that they rob the graves by midnight, and no one would venture to touch what is called quantar, or dried meat, in their houses, though they would not object to partake of fresh meat if they had seen the animal from which it came killed before them. Coffin relates, as eyewitness of the fact, the following story. Among his servants was a Buddha, who, one evening, whilst it was still light, came to his master and asked for leave absence till the following morning. He obtained the required leave and departed, but scarcely had Coffin turned his head when one of his men exclaimed, "Look, there he is changing himself into a hyena," pointing in the direction taken by the Buddha. Coffin turned to look, and although he did not witness the process of transformation, the young man had vanished from the spot from which he had been standing, not 100 paces distant. And in his place was a hyena running away. The place was a plain without either bush or tree to impede the view. Next morning, the young man returned and was charged by his companions with the transformation. This he'd rather acknowledge than deny, for he excused himself on the plea that it was the habit of his class. The statement of Pierce is corroborated by a note contributed by Sir Gardner Wilkinson to the Rawlinson's Herodotus book. A class of people in Absent City are believed to change themselves into hyenas when they like. On my appearing to discredit it, I was told by one who lived for years there that no well-informed person doubted it, and that he was once walking with one of them, when he happened to look away for a moment, and on turning again towards his companion, saw him trotting off in the shape of a hyena. He met him afterwards in his old form. These worthies are blacksmiths, G.W. A precisely similar superstition seems to have existed in America, for Joseph Acosta relates that the ruler of a city in Mexico, who was sent for by his predecessor, the predecessor of Montezuma, transformed himself before the eyes of those who were sent to seize him into an eagle, a tiger, and an enormous serpent. He yielded at last and was condemned to death. No longer in his own house, he was unable to work miracles so as to save his life. The Bishop of Chiapa, a province of Guatemala, in a writing published in 1702, ascribes the same power to the Nagals, or national priests, who labored to bring back to the religion of their ancestors the children brought up as Christians by their government. After various ceremonies, when the child instructed advanced to embrace him, the Nagual suddenly assumed a frightful aspect, and under the form of a lion or tiger appeared chained to the young Christian convert. Among the North American Indians, the belief in transformation is very prevalent. The following story closely resembles one very prevalent all over the world. I'm going to drink some of this water. Maybe I'll change into a wolf. Let's see what happens, huh? You never know, right? It's hot here. All right. We'll continue with our story. One Indian fixed his residence on the borders of the Great Bear Lake, taking with him only a dog. I'm sorry, we're going to change this. One Native American fixed his residence on the borders of the Great Bear Lake, taking with him only a dog, big with young. In due time, this dog brought forth 8 pups. I don't like where this is going. Whenever the Native American went out to fish, he tied up the pups to prevent them litter from straying. Several times as he approached his tent, he heard noises proceeding from it, which sounded like the talking, the laughing, the crying, the wail, and the merriment of children. But on entering it, he only perceived the pups tied up as usual. His curiosity began being excited by the noises he had heard. He determined to watch and learn whence these sounds proceeded and what they were. One day, he pretended to go out to fish, but instead of doing so, he concealed himself in a convenient place. In a short time, he again heard voices in rushing. Suddenly into the tent, beheld some beautiful children sporting and laughing, with the dogskins lying by their side. He threw the dogskins into the fire, and the children, retaining their proper forms, grew up, and were the ancestors of the Dog Rib Nation. This is from the book, from back in 1830, Traditions of the North American Indians by T.A. Jones. In the same work is a curious story entitled The Mother of the World, which bears a close analogy to another worldwide myth. A woman marries a dog. By night, the dog lays aside his skin and appears as a man. This may be compared with the tale of Jorn and Bera already given. I shall close this chapter with a Slovakian household tale given by T.T. Hanush in the third volume of Zeitschrift für Dietuchs. I told you it's not going to happen. It's actually called The Daughter of the Vikalak. I should have just said that. Okay. There was once a father who had 9 daughters, and they were all marriageable, but the youngest was the most beautiful. The father was a werewolf. One day it came into his head, what is the good of having to support so many girls? So he determined to put them all out of the way. He went accordingly into the forest to hew wood, and he ordered his daughters to let one of them bring him his dinner. It was the eldest who brought it. Why, how come you so early with the food? Asked the woodcutter. Truly, father, I wish to strengthen you, lest you should fall upon us, if famished. A good lass, sit down whilst I eat. He ate, and while he ate, he thought of a scheme. He rose and said, aye, my girl, come, and I will show you a pit I have been digging. And what is the pit for? That we may be buried in it when we die, for poor folk will not be cared for much after they are dead and gone. So the girl went with him to the side of the deep pit. Now here, said the werewolf, you must die and be cast in there. She begged for her life, but all in vain. So he laid hold of her and cast her into the grave. Then he took a great stone and flung it in upon her and unalived her. So the poor thing breathed out her soul. When the werewolf had done this, he went back to his work, and as dusk came on, the second daughter arrived, bringing him food. He told her of the pit, and brought her to it, and cast her in, and unalived her, just as he had done the first. And so he dealt with all his girls up to the last. The youngest knew well that her father was a werewolf, and she was grieved that her sisters did not return. She thought, now, where can they be? Has my father kept them for companionship, or to help him in his work? So she made the food which she was to take to him, and crept cautiously through the wood. When she came near the place where her father worked, she heard his strokes felling the timber, and smelled smoke. She saw presently a large fire and 2 human heads roasting at it. Yikes! Turning from the fire, she went in the direction of the axe strokes, and found her father. See, said she, father, I have brought you food. That's a good lass, said he. Now stack the wood for me whilst I eat. But where are my sisters? She asked. Down in yon valley drawing wood, he replied. Follow me, and I'll bring you to them. They came to the pit. Then he told her that he had dug it for a grave. Now, said he, you must die, and be cast into the pit with your sisters. Turn aside, father, she asked, while I strip of my clothes, and then slay me if you will. He turned aside as she requested, and then she gave him a push, and he tumbled headlong into the hole he had dug for her. She fled for her life, for the werewolf was not injured, and he soon would scramble out of the pit. Now, she hears his howls resounding through the gloomy alleys of the forest, and swift as the wind, she runs. She hears the tramp of his approaching feet and the snuffle of his breath. Then she casts behind her her handkerchief. The werewolf seizes this with teeth and nails, and rends it till it is reduced to tiny ribbons. In another moment, he is again in pursuit of foot, his pursuit foaming at the mouth, and howling dismally, whilst his red eyes gleam like burning coals. As he gains on her, she casts behind her her gown, and bids him to tear that. He seizes the gown and rips it to shreds. Then again, he pursues. This time, she casts behind her apron, next her petticoat, then her shift, and at last, roams much in the condition in which she was born. Again, the werewolf approaches. She bounds out of the forest into a hayfield and hides herself in the smallest heap of hay. Her father enters the field, runs howling about in search of her, cannot find her, and begins to upset the different haycocks. All the while, growling and gnashing his gleaming white fangs in his rage at her having escaped. The foam flakes drop at every step from his mouth, and his skin is reeking with sweat. Before he has reached the smallest bundle of hay, his strength leaves him. He feels exhaustion begin to creep over him, and he returns to the forest. The king goes out hunting every clay. One of his dogs carries food to the hayfield, which has most unaccountably been neglected by the haymakers for 3 days. The king, following the dog, discovers the fair damsel, not exactly in the straw, but up to her neck in hay. She's carried, hay and all, to the palace, where she becomes his wife, making only one stipulation before becoming his bride, and that is that no beggar shall be permitted to enter the palace. After some years, a beggar does get in. the beggar being, of course, none other than her werewolf father. He steals upstairs, enters the nursery, unalives the two children born by the queen or lord, and lays the knife under the pillow, under her pillow. In the morning, the king, supposing his wife to be the murderess, drives her from home with the dead princess hung, with the dead princess hung about her neck. A hermit comes to the rescue and restores the babies to life. The king finds out his mistake, is reunited with the lady out of the hay, and the werewolf is cast off a high cliff into the sea. And that is the end of him. The king, the queen, and the princess live happily, and may be living yet, for no notice of their death has appeared in the newspaper. Cool. This story bears some resemblance to the one told by von Hahn in his, I can't even pronounce that, book, okay? I remember having heard a very similar one in the Pyrenees. But the man who flies from the werewolf is one who, after having stripped off all his clothes, rushes into a cottage and jumps into a bed. The werewolf dares not or cannot follow. The cause of his flight was also different. He was a Freemason who had divulged a secret, and the werewolf was the master of his lodge in pursuit of him. In the Barani story, there is nothing similar to the last part of the Slovakia tale, and in the Greek one, the transformation and the pursuit are omitted, though the woman-eater is called Dog's Head, much as an outlaw in the north of Europe was said to be wolf-headed. It is worthy of notice in the tale of the daughter of the Ukalak that the werewolf fit is followed by great exhaustion, and that the werewolf is given clothes to tear, much as in the Danish stories already related. There does not seem to be any indication of his laving changed, of this having changed his shape. At least no change is mentioned. His hands are spoken of, and he swears and curses his daughter in broad Slovakian. The fit very closely resembles that to which Skallagrim, the Icelander, was subject. It is a pity that the maid, Brack, in the Icelandic tale, did not fall upon her legs like the young lady in the hay. Okay, so, next chapter. We're going to look at natural causes of lycanthropy. So let's see if there's natural causes to make people werewolves. What I have related from the Chronicles of Antiquity or from the traditional lore of the people is veiled under the form of myth or legend. It is only from Scandinavian descriptions of those afflicted with wolf madness, and from the trials of those charged with the crime of lycanthropy in the latter Middle Ages, that we can arrive at the truth respecting that form of madness which was invested by the superstitious with so much mystery. It was not till the close of the Middle Ages that lycanthropy was recognized as a disease, but it is one which has so much that is ghastly and revolting in its form. It is so remote from all our ordinary experience that it is not surprising that the casual observer should leave the consideration of it as a subject isolated and perplexing, and be disposed to regard it as a myth that which the feared investigation might prove a reality. In this chapter, I propose briefly examining the conditions under which men have been regarded as werewolves. Let me double check some power over here. Okay. If my phone completely runs out of juice, it may not come back, so I'm just trying to watch, get to a certain point and shut down, put it on the charger, and I'll have to shut you guys down over there on TikTok. But if you like what you're hearing, double tap that screen. I do this every Sunday. Thank you for the like over there. I don't know who did it, but thank you. I see it over there on my screen over there on StreamYard. Startling, though, the assertion may be, it is a matter of fact that man, naturally, in common with other carnivora, is actuated by an impulse to kill and by a love of destroying life. It is positively true that there are many to whom the sight of suffering causes genuine pleasure, and in whom the passion to kill or torture is as strong as any other passion. Witness the number of boys who assemble around a sheep or pig when it is about to be killed, and who watch the struggle of the dying brute with hearts beating fast with pleasure and eyes sparkling with delight. Often I have seen an eager crowd of children assembled around the slaughterhouses of French towns, absorbed in the expiring agonies of the sheep and cattle, and hushed into silence as they watched the flow of blood. The propensity, however, exists in different degrees. In some, it is manifest simply as indifference to suffering. In others, it appears seeking pleasure in seeing killed, and in others, again, it is dominant as an irresistible desire to torture and destroy. It is widely diffused. It exists in children and adults, and the gross-minded and the refined, and the well-educated and the ignorant, and those who have never had the opportunity of gratifying it, and those who gratify it habitually, in spite of morality, religion, laws, so that it can only depend on constitutional causes. The sportsman and the fisherman follow a natural instinct to destroy. When they make wax on a bird, beast, and fish, the pretense that the spoil is sought for the table cannot be made with justice, as the sportsman cares little for the game he has obtained. But once it is consigned to his pouch, boom, okay? The motive for his eager pursuit of bird or beast must be sought elsewhere. It will be found in the natural craving to extinguish life, which exists in his soul. Why does a child impulsively strike at a butterfly as it flits past him? He cares nothing for the insect when once it is beaten down on his feet, unless it is quivering in its agony, when he will watch it with interest. The child strikes at the fluttering creature because it has life in it, and he has an instinct within him impelling him to destroy life wherever he finds it. Parents and nurses know well that children by nature are cruel, and that humanity has to be acquired by education. A child will gloat over the sufferings of a wounded animal till his mother bids him put it out of its misery. An unsophisticated child would not dream of terminating the poor creature's agonies abruptly any more than he would swallow whole a bonbon till he had well sucked it. Inherent cruelty may be obscured by after impressions, or may be kept under moral restraint. The person who is consensually a Nero may scarcely know his own nature, till by some accident the master passion becomes dominant and sweeps all before it. A relaxation of the moral check, a shock to the controlling intellect, an abnormal condition of body, are sufficient to allow the passion to assert itself. As I have already observed, this passion exists in different persons in different degrees. In some, it is exhibited in a simple want of feeling for other people's sufferings. This temperament may lead to crime, for the individual who is regardless of pain in another will be ready to destroy that other, if it suits his own purposes. Such a one was the pauper Dumoulin, who was the murderer of at least 6 poor girls, and who attempted to unalive several others. He seems not to have felt much gratification in unaliving them, but to have been so utterly indifferent to their sufferings that he killed them solely for the sake of their clothes, which were of the poorest description. He was sentenced to the guillotine and executed in 1862. Okay. In others, the passion for blood is developed alongside with indifference to suffering. Thus, Andries Michel enticed young women into his house under the pretense that he was possessed of a magic mirror in which he would show them their future husbands. When he had them in his power, he bound their hands behind their backs and stunned them with a blow. Okay. He then unalived them and despoiled them of their clothes, for the sake of which he committed the murders. But as he unalived the young women, the passion of cruelty took possession of him, and he did unthinkable things to the poor girls whilst they were still alive, in his anxiety to examine their insides. Okay. Catherine Seidel was opened up. We're just going to leave it at that. I may say, he remarked at his trial, that during the operation I was so eager that I trembled all over, and I longed to rive off a piece and eat it. Okay, please remember, I'm trying to get through this. I'm trying to smooth it out. So do not turn me into the TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, or any of those police. Okay, I'm doing my best to sort through this stuff as I'm going through. Again, a third class of persons are cruel and bloodthirsty, because in them, bloodthirstiness is a raging, insatiable passion. In a civilized country, those possessed by this passion are forced to control it through fear of the consequences, or to gratify it upon the brute creation. But in earlier days, when the feudal lords were supreme in their domains, there have been frightful instances of their excesses, and the extent to which some of the Roman emperors indulged their passion for blood is a matter of history. Gall gives several authentic instances of bloodthirstiness. A Dutch priest had such a desire to kill and to see killed that he became chaplain to a regiment that he might have the satisfaction of seeing deaths occurring wholesale in engagements. The same man kept a large collection of various kinds of domestic animals that he might be able to torture their young. He had alive the animals for the kitchen and was acquainted with all the hangmen in the country who sent him notice of executions. And he would walk for days that he might have the gratification of seeing a man executed. Okay, there we go on that one. Excuse me. In the field of battle, the passion is variously developed. Some feel positive delight in slaying. Others are indifferent. An old soldier who had been in Waterloo informed me that, to his mind, there was no pleasure equal to running a man through the body, okay, and that he could lie awake at night musing on the pleasurable sensations afforded him by that act. Highwaymen are frequently not content with robbery, but manifest a bloody inclination to torment an unalive. John Rosbeck, for instance, is well known to have invented and exercised the most atrocious cruelties, merely that he might witness the suffering of his victims, who were especially women and children. Neither fear nor torture could break him of the dreadful passion till he was executed. Gall tells of a violin player who, being arrested, confessed to 34 murders, all of which he had committed not from enmity or intent to rob, but solely because it afforded him an intense pleasure. Spurzheim tells of a priest at Strasbourg who, though rich and uninfluenced by envy or revenge, from exactly the same motive killed three people. Gall relates the case of a brother of the Duke of Bourbon, Condé, Count of Charlois, who from infancy had an irreverent pleasure in torturing animals. Growing older, he lived to shed the blood of human beings and to exercise various kinds of cruelty. He also unalived many from no other motive and shot at slaters for the pleasure of seeing them fall from the roofs of houses. Louis XI of France caused the death of 4,000 people during his reign. He used to watch their executions from a neighboring lattice. He had gibbets placed outside his own palace and himself conducted the executions. It must not be supposed that cruelty exists merely in the coarse and rude. It is quite as frequently observed in the refined and educated. Among the former, is a manifest chiefly in insensibility to the sufferings of others. In the latter, it appears as a passion, the indulgence of which causes intense pleasure. Those bloody tyrants, Nero and Caligula, Alexander Borgia and Robespierre, whose highest enjoyment consisted in witnessing the agonies of their fellow men, were full of delicate sensibilities and great refinement of taste and manner. I have seen an accomplished young woman of considerable refinement and of a highly strung, nervous temperament, string flies with their needle on a piece of thread, and watch the complacency of their flutterings. Cruelty may remain latent till, by some accident, it is aroused, and then it will break forth in a devouring flame. It is the same with the passion for blood as with the passions of love and hate. We have no conception of the violence with which they can rage till circumstances occur which call them into action. Love or hate will be dominant in a breast which has been in serenity till suddenly the spark falls. Passion blazes forth, and the serenity of the quiet breast is shattered forever. A word, a glance, a touch are sufficient to fire the magazine of passion in the heart and to desolate forever in existence. It is the same with bloodthirstiness. It may lurk in the deeps of some heart very dear to us, and may smolder in the bosom which is most cherished by us, and we may be perfectly unconscious of its existence there. Perhaps circumstances will not cause its development, Perhaps normal principle may have bound it down with fetters, kind of wish feathers that couldn't break. Michael Wegener relates a horrible story in which occurred in Hungary, suppressing the name of the person, as it was that of a still powerful family in the country. It illustrates what I've been saying and shows how trifling a matter may develop the passion in its most hideous proportions. I'll try and clean this up as I go, you guys. It's kind of, I don't want anybody to get grossed out in problem. Let me wipe real quick. It is really hot in here, so let me deal with that. There we go. Elizabeth, no last name, was wont to dress well in order to please her husband. She spent half the day over her toilet. On one occasion, a lady's maid saw something wrong in her headdress, and as a recompense for observing it, received such a severe box on the ears that the blood gushed from her nose and spirted onto her mistress's face. When the blood drops were washed off her face, her skin appeared much more beautiful, whiter, and more transparent on the spots where the blood had been. Elizabeth formed the resolution to bathe her face and her whole body in human blood so as to enhance her beauty. Two old women and a certain Fitzko assisted her in her undertaking. This monster used to kill the luckless victim, and the old women caught the blood, in which Elizabeth was wont to bathe at the hour of 4 in the morning. After the bath, she appeared more beautiful than before. She continued this habit after the death of her husband, 1604, in the hope of gaining new suitors. The unhappy girls who were lured to the castle, under the plea that they were to be taken into service, therefore were locked up in a cellar. Here they were beaten till they were swollen. Elizabeth not infrequently tortured her victims herself. Often she changed their clothes, which dripped with their blood, and then renewed her cruelties. The bodies were then divided up with razors. Occasionally, she had the girls burned and then divided up, but the great majority were beaten until they were unalive. At last, her cruelty became so great that she would stick needles into those who sat with her in a carriage, especially if they were of her own sex. One of her servant girls, she stripped naked, smeared her with honey, and so drove her out of the house. When she was ill and could not indulge her cruelty, she bit someone who came near her sick bed as though she were a wild beast. She caused in all the death of, 650 girls. Some in Tashita, on the neutral ground where she had a cellar constructed for the purpose. Others in different localities, for murder and bloodshed became with her a necessity. When at last the parents of the lost children could no longer be calmed, the castle was seized, and the traces of the murders were discovered. Her accomplices were executed, and she was imprisoned for life. An equally remarkable example will be found in the account of the Marechal del Retz, given at some length in the sequel. He was an accomplished man, a scholar, an able general, and a courtier. But suddenly, the impulse to murder and destroy came upon him while sitting in the library reading. Suetonius, he yielded to the impulse and became one of the greatest monsters of cruelty the world has ever produced. The case of Zivitik, the Galician cannibal, is also to the purpose. This man was a harmless pauper till one day accident brought him to the scene of a conflagration. Hunger impelled him to taste of the roasted fragments of the human being who had perished in the fire, and from that moment he ravished for man's flesh. Yeah. And Bertrand was a French gentleman of taste and education. He one day lounged over the churchyard wall in a quiet country village and watched a funeral. Instantly, an overwhelming desire to dig up and rend the corpse, which he had seen committed to the ground, came upon him. And for years he lived as a human hyena, preying upon the dead. His story is given in detail in the 15th chapter. An abnormal condition of body sometimes produces this desire for blood. It is manifest in certain cases of pregnancy, which the constitution loses its balance and the appetite becomes deceased. Shank gives instances. A pregnant woman saw a baker carrying loaves on his bare shoulder. She was at once filled with such craving for his flesh that she refused to taste any food till her husband persuaded the baker, by the offer of a large sum, to allow his wife to bite him. The man yielded, and the woman fleshed her teeth into his shoulder twice, but he held out no longer. The wife bore twins on three occasions, twice living, the third time dead. One woman, in an interesting addition, near Andernach on the Rhine, murdered her husband, to whom she was warmly attached. She ate half his body and salted the rest. When the passion left her, she became conscious of the horrible nature of her act, and she gave herself up to justice. Well, we're back to this. Hang on. I hate this. Okay. How to do verification, you guys. God, I hate when TikTok does that. Last time I got cut off because I didn't get it done in time. Where are we at, time-wise? Okay. In 1553, a wife cut her husband's throat and gnawed off the nose and left arm whilst the body was yet warm. She then cut the corpse up and salted it for future consumption. Shortly after, she gave birth to three children, and she only became conscious of what she had done when her neighbors asked after the father, that they might announce to him the arrival of the little ones. In the summer of 1845, the Greek papers contained an account of a pregnant woman unaliving her husband for the purpose of roasting and eating his liver. Yikes. That the passion to destroy it, prevalent in certain maniacs, is well known. This is sometimes accompanied by cannibalism. Gruner gives an account of a shepherd who was evidently deranged who killed and ate two men. Mark relates that the woman, during the absence of her husband, a poor laborer, murdered her son, a lad 15 months old. She unalived him and stewed his various body parts with cabbage. She ate a portion and offered the rest to her husband. It is true that the family were very poor, but there was food in the house at the time. In prison, the woman gave evident signs of derangement. The cases in which bloodthirstiness and cannibalism are united with sanity are those which properly fall under the head of lycanthropy. The instances recorded in the preceding chapter point unmistakably to hallucination accompanying the lust for blood. Jean Grenier, René, and others were firmly convinced that they had undergone transformation. A disordered condition of mind or body may produce hallucination in a form depending on the character and instincts of the individual. Thus, an ambitious man laboring under monomania will imagine himself to be a king. A covetous man will be plunged into despair, believing himself to be penniless. And exult at the vastness of the treasure, which he imagines that he has discovered. The old man suffering from rheumatism or gout conceives himself to be formed of china or glass, and the fox hunter tally-hoes at each new moon, as though he were following a pack. In like manner, the naturally cruel man, if the least affected in his brain, will suppose himself to be transformed into the most cruel and bloodthirsty animal with which he is acquainted. The hallucinations under which lycanthropists suffered may have arisen from various causes. The older writers, as Forestus and Burston, regard the werewolf mania as a species of melancholy madness, and some do not deem it necessary for the patient to believe in this transformation, for them to regard him as a werewolf. In the present state of medical knowledge, this is the 1800s, okay, so this is old stuff. In the present state of medical knowledge, we know that very different conditions may give rise to hallucinations. In fever cases, the sensibility is so disturbed that the patient is often deceived as to the space occupied by his limbs, and he supposes them to be preternaturally distended. Preternaturally distended or contracted. In the case of typhus, it is not uncommon for the sick person with the deranged nervous system to believe himself to be double in bed, or to be severed in half, or to have lost his limbs. He may regard his members as composed of foreign and often fragile materials, as glass, or he may lose his personality, as to suppose himself to have become a woman. A monomaniac who believes himself to be someone else seeks to enter into the feelings, thoughts, and habits of the assumed personality, and from the facility with which this is effected. He draws an argument conclusive to himself of the reality of the change. He thenceforth speaks of himself under the assumed character and experiences all his needs, wishes, passions, and the like. The closer the identification becomes, the more confirmed is the monomaniac and his madness, the character of which varies with the temperament of the individual. If the person's mind be weak or rude and uncultivated, the tenacity with which he clings to his metamorphosis is feebler, and it becomes more difficult to draw the line between his lucid and insane utterances. Thus, Jean Grenier, who labored under this form of mania, said in his trial much that was true. But it was mixed with the ramblings of insanity. Hallucination may also be produced by artificial means, and there are evidences afforded by the confessions of those tried for lycanthropy that these artificial means were employed by them. I refer to the cell so frequently mentioned in witch and werewolf trials. The following passage is from the charming golden ass of Apuleius. Good God. It proves that salves were extensively used by witches for the purpose of transformation, even in his day. Photos showed me a crack in the door and bade me look through it, upon which I looked and saw Pamphile first divest herself of all her garments, and then, having unlocked a chest, take from it several little boxes, and open one of the latter, which contained a certain ointment. Rubbing this ointment a good while previously between the palms of her hands, she anointed her whole body from the very nails of her toes to the hair on the crown of her head, and when she was anointed all over, she whispered many magic words to a lamp, as if she were talking to it. Then she began to move her arms, first with tremendous jerks, and afterwards by a gentle undulating motion, till the glittering downy surface by degrees overspread her body. Feathers and strong quills burst forth suddenly. Her nose became a hard, crooked beak. Her toes changed to curved talons, and Pamphile was no longer Pamphile, but it was an owl I saw before me. And now, uttering a harsh, querulous scream, leaping from the ground by little and little, in order to try her powers, and presently posing herself aloft on her pinions. She stretched forth her wings on either side of her, to their full extent, and flew straight away, having now been actually a witness of the performance of the magical art and of the metamorphosis of Pamphile. I remained for some time in a stupefied state of astonishment. At last, after I had rubbed my eyes some time, had recovered a little from the amazement and abstraction of the mind, and began to feel a consciousness of the reality of things about me, I took hold of the hand of Fotis and said, "Sweet damsel, bring me, I beseech thee, a portion of the ointment with which thy mistress hath just now anointed. And when thou hast made me a bird, I will be thy slave, and even wait upon thee like a winged cupid." Accordingly, she crept gently into the apartment, quickly returned with the box of ointment, hastily placed it in my hands, and then immediately departed. Elated to an extraordinary degree at the sight of the precious treasure, I kissed the box several times successfully, and uttering repeated aspirations and hopes of a prosperous flight, I stripped off my clothes as quick as possible, dipped my fingers greedily into the box, and having thence extracted a good large lump of ointment, rubbed it all over my body and limbs. When I was thoroughly anointed, I swung my arms up and down, in imitation of the movement of a bird's pinions, and continued to do so for a little while, when instead of any perceptible token of feathers or wings making their appearance, my own thin skin, alas, grew into a hard leathern hide covered with bristly hair. My fingers and toes disappeared, the palms of my hands and the soles of my feet became four soiled hooves. And from the end of my spine, a long tail projected. My face was enormous, my mouth wide, my nostrils gaping, my lips pendulous, and I had a pair of immoderately long, rough, hairy ears. In short, when I came to contemplate my transformation to its full extent, I found that instead of a bird, I had become a donkey. Of what these magical salves were composed of, we know. They were composed of narcotics, to wit. Solanum, somnifone, aconite, High Soul Connections, Belladum, Opium, of course, Mulgrew Seum. These were boiled down with oil, or the fat of little children who were murdered for the purpose. The blood of a bat was added, but its effects could have been nil. To these may have been added other foreign narcotics, the names of which have not transpired. Whatever may have been the cause of the hallucination, it is not surprising that the Lycanthropos should have imagined himself transformed into a beast. The cases I have instanced are those of shepherds who were, by nature of their employment, brought into collision with wolves. And it is not surprising that these persons, in a condition liable to hallucinations, should imagine themselves to be transformed into wild beasts, and that their minds reverting to the injuries sustained from these animals, they should, in their state of temporary insanity, accuse themselves of the acts of rapidly committed by they believe themselves to be transformed. It is a well-known fact that men whose minds are unhinged will deliver themselves up to justice, accusing themselves of having crimes which have actually taken place. And it is only on investigation that their self-accusation proves to be false, and yet they will describe the circumstances with the greatest minuteness and be thoroughly convinced of their own criminality. I need give but a single instance. In the war of the French Revolution, the Hermoine frigate was commanded by Captain Pigot, a harsh man and a severe commander. His crew mutinied and carried the ship into an enemy's port, having unalived the captain and several of the officers under circumstances of extreme barbarity. One midshipman escaped, by whom many of the criminals, who were afterwards taken and delivered over to justice, one by one were identified. Mr. Finelson, the government actuary, who at that time held an official situation in the Admiralty, states, "In my own experience, I have known on separate occasions more than six sailors who voluntarily confessed to having struck the first blow at Captain Pigot. These men detailed all the horrid circumstances of the mutiny with extreme minuteness and perfect accuracy. Nevertheless, not one of them had ever been in a ship, nor had they so much as seen Captain Pigot in their lives. They had obtained, by tradition, from their messmates, the particulars of the story. When long on a foreign station, hungering and thirsting for home, their minds became enfeebled. At length, they actually believed themselves to be guilty of the crime over which they had so long brooded, and submitted with a gloomy pleasure to being sent to England in irons for judgment. At the Admiralty, we were always able to detect and establish their innocence in defiance of their own solemn assertions." All right, guys, that is it. That is the end of the book, the chapter. So we are done for the day. I want to thank everybody for coming today and joining me. For those of you on TikTok who stuck with me, that's great. Double tap that screen if you enjoyed this book read. Well, it's kind of creepy book read. Marisa, I see you in the chat room. And tomorrow, again, I will be starting the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation radio show. But that runs Sunday through Sunday through Friday, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. And tomorrow night's guest will be Yvonne Smith, and she's going to be talking about alien abductions and the hybrid program. So she's going to be on tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. So come on over and join us, you guys at TikTok. I really appreciate you being here. That's youtube.com/@CaliforniaHauntsRadio. All right, TikTok, I'm going to say goodnight, and I'll see you either tomorrow at youtube.com/@CaliforniaHauntsRadio, or I'll see you next Sunday, 6 p.m. Pacific. We do this every weekend. Okay? Bye. Okay, everybody, let me get up here. Hang on. Ah. Woo! It's hot here. All right, thank you everybody for coming tonight. Again, tomorrow we do start out our week with Yvonne R. Smith, and she's going to be talking about the hybrid program and some information, new information she's got about alien abductions and things like that. So that's what we're going to be discussing tomorrow with her. So thank you guys all for coming today, and I will see you guys tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. And have a great rest of your Sunday.